Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, June 22nd, 2001. In the fireside room this afternoon is John Marty. Today's session is titled Political Town Meeting. Let's listen in.
It's supposed to be a sort of an open forum to discuss or ask questions or whatever about anything. One year I tried this and called it everything you wanted to know about politics but were afraid to ask. And I'll open it up. I'm John Marty, a state senator from Minnesota for 14 some years. Won most of the races I've been in. I ran for governor about 6 years ago and made it through the primary, but got beat soundly in November. So anything from public policy to politics is fair game. And I'll start it out by throwing out two or three types of things that I hear lots of questions about, one of which I'm going to not focus on much, but the money in politics issue. Bill Moyers wrote an article, a cover story of Sojourner's Magazine a year or two ago, and the headline of the cover story was the role of the money in politics, or the negative influence of money in politics, is not as bad as you think. Period. It's worse. And it's an interesting issue because most elected officials, well, yeah, it's a real serious problem. It's a bad public perception. They think that we take the money and are selling our votes for money. And public thinks, well, to a certain point, the public may think that's happening. Elected officials think it's purely a public perception problem for the most part. And Bill Moyers, who's been involved in covering and actually involved in politics up to the presidential level over his career, is one who knows it inside and out. And so when he says it's worse than you, the public think, he means it. And I happen to think, I have a talk on this next week, so I'm not going to go into great detail now, but I happen to think that it's not just perception. If it was, you should run a PR campaign saying how, no, it's not really a problem. But it is a problem, not that individual public officials of any party or any philosophy or something are crooked or on the take, because while there certainly are some, they're a small, I hope very small, minority. And the problem is that people who get money, they're all human beings, we're all human beings. Somebody gives you $1,000, you're gonna look a little more favorably upon them. If you have so-and-so limited time to respond to thousands of letters and phone calls and requests for meetings, you may be a little bit more inclined to, if somebody's given you a large contribution, to say, sure, I'd be happy to meet with you. And you're a little more inclined to listen favorably when you hear from them. And so lobbyists know that. They give money to candidates of both parties. They give money to both parties. Until states, in a number of states like Minnesota, have limited it, they gave lavish gifts, lots of entertainment, not always lavish gifts, just routine things. There was one guy in Minnesota when they were allowed to do this, a lobbyist who came in every morning with donuts and bagels to certain offices. One new staffer or intern or something came up to another staff member a few years ago and said, who's that caterer? And no, this was just a lobbyist who knew how to make friends every day. Well, sure, he's always present, always there, a favor, just dropping this stuff off as a favor. But who's around to have your ear at the right moment? Money in politics, as Bill Moyers says, the problem is worse than you think. And public officials, because they would say, and I think legitimately a lot of them, if you gave them an envelope with $1,000 cash in, they'd turn and run. They would not want to be in the room with you. They would be afraid of that. On the other hand, subconsciously, the gifts they get, the campaign contributions, does have a real impact. One other one I'm going to point out is the issue of short-term thinking versus long-term thinking. I suggest that in politics, long-term thinking in modern American politics, long-term thinking is the next election. Short-term thinking is this week. last night we had a forum, and Peter Pangborn, who's public information person from Hanford Nuclear Waste Facility in here in Washington, the biggest hazardous waste site in the country, 53 million gallons of high-level nuclear waste, and much of it has leaked already into, when it reaches the underground aquifers, we don't know. When that gets to the Columbia River, we don't know what the consequences are, we don't know. We do know it's not good, and he says it's going to be probably a $40 billion cleanup project. And the plans they have in place, the timeline they have in place, are build it over the next 5 years, and then it'll take 30 to 40 years to clean up. So he figures 40 years to get it all cleaned up. But to do that, the start has to be $400 million before they actually start the construction of the facility. And the new administration has committed $65 million to it and says, look, we're trying to address it. We're putting more money into this. Well, he says, Peter says, they're going to have to cancel the contracts they already have because they don't have the money. Why don't public officials address that? That's a long-term problem. In many ways, it's not our problem. It's our grandchildren's problem. And that's very short-term thinking, and it will cost them many thousands of times more to deal with the mess. And Chernobyl area in the Soviet Union, with the radiation stuff, there's many square miles nobody should live anywhere near for a long, long time. So short-term thinking is prevalent, and I would argue it's not just in environmental issues, but that's one of the things the forum last night, lots of people, why isn't there pressure to do something about this? It's because it doesn't hit right away. And it also happens in terms of investments that may save money. Tomorrow I'm going to be talking about mental health and chemical dependency. State of California, 8-9 years ago, did a study on chemical dependency treatment, concluded every dollar that taxpayers spend on treating chemical dependency saves taxpayers about $7 in reduced crime and healthcare costs. 700% rate of return is a pretty good deal, but do we do it? No, no state, including California, does more than token funding. I mean, I should say it's more than token. There are people who get treatment in every state with public funds, but it's a tiny fraction of those who need the help. But these are two issues I'd be happy to explore in this, but basically wanted to open it up to those or any of whatever 1,000 different things you might want to talk about. So, anybody want to lead off with something? No. Yes?
Isn't one of our super big issues, and a very hard one to sort out, the individual rights versus common good?
Okay. Do you want to comment more on that, or just looking for sort of an open?
Well, open, but it seems to me that both of those are values that we have as a society and as a people. The trade-off there, I think, must be an incredibly difficult one for you and other legislators. And, you know, people will come down perhaps closer to one or the other of those, but you can't go to either radical extreme.
Right. Well, I was going to suggest that it's usually not a difficult issue for any one public official for two reasons. One, because there's not a lot of thought often going into the political process. I think there are very many brilliant people in politics, but too often you get tied up in the minutiae of what you're working on at the time, and too little long-term thinking, and that's part of it. The other part of it is a lot of it people have their, as you sort of referred to, is their minds made up that they tend to lean over this way or that way. I would argue it's not a difficult, in this country, we don't have to worry about it going too much to the common good, because the Constitution very much favors or guarantees individual rights in very many ways. Right against somebody taking away anything of yours without due process, without compensation. Those are constitutional guarantees, and because they're federal constitution guarantees, even if state constitutions don't guarantee it, it is protected. In terms of that, I mean, they're not absolute. There are cases where you can have certain things that some people would argue are yours that are being taken away. Best example I'd give right now, there's a whole lot of legislation concerned, I'm not sure how best to describe it, but legislation that deals with protecting individual property owners when government does something that may negatively influence your property. If you own a piece of real estate and right next to it government puts in or allows somebody else to build some wonderful retail thing and you've got business property, you may just happen to have a tremendously valued piece of property. You get the gain and benefit because they do something that boosts your property. If they do something that or allow something to happen that may reduce your property value, you demand compensation for it. And I've always wondered how much we should play this game, because the best example I have is in terms of, and I don't think I talked about this during the corporate subsidies talk I did the other day, but in the Mall of America, when that was built 10, 12 years ago, and some people took some risks, not big risks, but they took some risks and promised to build this big piece of property. There were some subsidies involved in it, and it's been a booming success. And if they built so and so many square footage of retail by 1991 or so, they were going to be allowed to buy a property just adjacent to the mall for, I don't know how many acres it was, for $1, 30 acres or something of land that was quite valuable. They would be allowed to redevelop it and would be given it for $1 if they developed. And they did develop the square footage they needed, so they got this land for $1. Which was worth far more than that, but that was part of the deal. It happens to be that that property is near the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport, and they were in the interesting position where the lobbyists for the Mall of America were lobbying at the Capitol to make sure the airport stayed put, because there was a proposal to move it further away because we needed expansion and so on. They lobbied very aggressively to keep the airport put in the same location, expanding it there because it's good for them. They want the people who fly in from Japan and everywhere else to go shopping there. It's very convenient. At the same time they were lobbying for that, they were making it real clear and spelling out the legal case they were going to use that if the airport stays there and has to build this new runway, which again they were all advocating for, the runway required height clearance that meant that you couldn't build anything more than 4 stories high or something on this new property. So they said, well, at the same time they were arguing that they wanted the airport there, they wanted the airport expansion there, they were also going around and lobbying to make it clear that if you guys don't give us something in exchange for this, we're gonna sue. And the state, the city did, and the Airports Commission gave into it and basically traded a 50-acre piece of property. The state actually threw in development incentives, even though it was financial subsidy, even though it was the most developable property in the state and one of the most valuable in the country. So they gave them a bigger piece of property. They paid $1 for the first one. They knew at the time they were getting it, it had these restrictions on it and it would get worse. And in exchange, they got that. They argued both sides. Government, well, we expect you to do this, and we're going to benefit from the airport here. We wouldn't lobby for the airport to stay here if it was going to hurt us more than it was going to help us. But at the same time, they then turn away and say that because it's here and helping us, it's also going to have this other restriction on us, so you got to give us more of something else in exchange for it. I'd argue that common good should be a little fairer balance there, that we shouldn't be we shouldn't trample on anybody's individual rights, but there are many times that we as a society don't think about what's good for all of us. And that comes out a lot in the public attitude. Let's not spend money on education. I don't have kids in school. I don't want to spend my tax dollars on that. And frankly, we all benefit from a strong community. And I would suggest that our American society pays too little attention to what's the common good. And I think our Constitution will guarantee we will never go too far away from individual rights, but we don't do enough to move to look at what we are allowed to do and should be doing. Yes.
Well, maybe another example of that that I don't understand is we've been struggling to lower the alcohol level that's permissible.
Right.
So I'm wondering, well, why would anybody be against that? I mean, as far as thinking of the common good. Of course, somebody told me, well, the liquor sellers are against it. So wouldn't that be for the common good?
And basically what we in public office are supposed to be doing is looking out for the common good, though the common good in that sense includes individual well-being as well. I think the common good includes making sure that you, when you're on the road, aren't at risk of being killed by a drunk driver. The 0.08 alcohol debate is slowly happening. The federal government now has significant financial incentives for it to happen. I introduced a bill to do that in Minnesota in 1992. Couldn't even get a House author for the bill. Now it's the point where it's going to happen soon. I think like 20, 30 states have now done it, and others will in the near future, I think. It's interesting, the debate. I mean, I think the arguments are clear, so I'm sold on the concept. I've been for a long time. Under federal law, if you drive a truck, it's 0.04, half that much alcohol. Most Scandinavian, most European countries are 0.05, some are 0.02. It's clear, the Federal Highway Traffic, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration has declared, they're the fact they put out, and it's an interpretation, but it's something they're willing to go out online saying is that virtually every driver is significantly impaired at 0.08. The liquor industry says, yeah, well, no, you're not intoxicated. The really dangerous drunks are those at 0.20, more than double the alcohol concentration. Yeah, they are. I mean, if you can hardly stand up, you are more likely to be in an accident than somebody at 0.08. And so they try and describe it as a minimal thing, though working on the issue, I've met several people, a woman who lost both her parents to a 0.08 driver, a woman who lost her husband and almost lost her 11-year-old son to a 0.09 driver, all of which is, they can nail those guys afterwards because they can serve time in prison, but I'd argue 0.08. Knowing it's less, people are afraid. They don't drink quite as much. Which is what the liquor industry is afraid of. It's interesting, the states that have it haven't lost that much sales, but in any one setting, people don't drink quite as much. I think it's a great idea, but the liquor industry fights it. Is that common good? It's common good in the sense that, yeah, everybody benefits, but it's individual good that I don't get hit by a drunk driver. Yeah, go ahead.
What's your thoughts on the amount of time allowed for election campaign and so on? My thoughts would be we spend, say, 10 to 12 months for a one-day election. These people that are working for the election are taking time away from their regular jobs and so on. I don't think it's proper. I would say propose, this is my thought, 1 month we have an X number of dollars to be spent. That's it. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'd love to see a shorter season. It's difficult to do. I think a lot of countries have 3-week election seasons. When I ran for governor in 94, it was 93-94. I jumped in June of 93, 17 months out. And I was the second last major candidate to get into the race. Others had been in for a year already. And most people aren't paying attention, but a lot of the most important decisions happen then. And the fundraising certainly goes on then. Minnesota has one of the latest primaries anywhere in the country, where it's the second Tuesday after the first Monday in September, so it's usually as late as September 15th. And the week before that, somewhere in that range it falls, 7 or 8 weeks before the general election in November. And what do we hear in Minnesota? Both political parties and a lot of legislators are trying to move the primary till June. Three times as long, in their theory as well, then you won't have such divisive primaries, you can get to the real campaign later. My argument is people don't pay attention that long, campaigns are too long, they get sick of it.
Right.
We don't need television ads in April, May, June, which plenty of other states do have. I'd like to see them shorter. The difficulty is, how do you do it? You get in late, I mean, free speech, we can't, that's the difficulty with campaign finance reform too. I think there's a lot we can constitutionally do, but we cannot, according to the courts and the First Amendment, which I think they misinterpret a little bit, but we cannot do much to stop people from spending money. If we set spending limits, as Minnesota and a few other states have, it has to be voluntary, tied to public subsidies. Minnesota, we've got it. I'm proud of the fact that we have a system that virtually 100% of candidates at the state level comply with. So if we dish out that money a little bit later, that helps. But again, if you kind of, well, I'm going to do as much groundwork as I can ahead of then, I think there's some things we can do to move it tighter. And I strongly oppose those moves, which passed in the Senate and the House different years, never the same year for both of them, to triple the length of our primary season, just because I think you don't get more debate than you compress it, you'll actually have more, I think you'll have more people paying attention. People get sick of it when it's year-round thing.
Right. I have a couple areas of concern that I'd be interested in your response to. One is the energy question. And the Arctic Wildlife Refuge is just, I think, a tip of the iceberg in terms of leadership that I would look to or look for that would offer possibly ration, possibly more funding for alternative energy sources, for cars that are more fuel efficient. We seem to follow the Japanese. They need to, they pressure us in the automobile industry into making changes. And so I'm wondering if we'll move toward conservation and stewardship around hydropower, fossil fuels, etc., when we're forced to, is that what it'll take? And then my second question is around the space missile defense system.
Okay.
And at least as I read history, the Russians have not let us one up them. And if we choose to break the 1973 treaty, our European allies are saying, you know, we don't want you to do that. It seems like America always has to have an enemy, whether it's an imagined rogue state or, and I'm troubled by this kind of leadership that pushes us to now take nuclear weapons into space to defend us when we already have so many weapons that we were negotiating with the Russians to reduce the number. And yet it seems like we're going in a different direction now. So
okay.
Those are my two
areas. First, on the energy issue, I think you make a good point. I agree with you what you're saying. The Arctic Wildlife Refuge, if we do risk that in order to drill, I'm told that would provide something like 6 months' supply of our nation's energy needs. You know, we destroyed millions of acres of precious wilderness for that purpose. I think your approach is the right one. I think rationing would be extremely hard sell, short of something like wartime, though California may make people think twice, but there's so much we can do. I was going to say, Holden, here at Holden, we try and model things for people, but I was going to say, we shouldn't model the energy use here because it's hydropower and it's not unlimited, but it's not costing anybody any more to use more power in the summer so people are careless with the lights. Nevertheless, even not just the behavior, the individual behavior, turning off lights when you leave a room, which last night after the forum, Peter and I were talking about how so many places, state government, our state capitol, I walk through room after room any time of the day, there are people not in a room and the lights are all on. Some of it's changes like that. Some of it's technologies where if there's nobody movement in a room for 15 minutes, the lights all go off. That's easily available. It easily pays for itself in a place like that where nobody pays attention to it. More efficient lighting, more efficient energy consumption. When I was first elected, the Isaac Walton League had asked, they were frustrated because energy efficiency for appliances. The Reagan administration was saying they were willing to live with it, but somehow or another the industry was bottling up a pretty modest bill for a couple of years. And so what Isaac Walton League had, they approached legislators in 40 different states. We all dropped in standards for our own states, and all of a sudden the industry, oh no, they were horrified that, you know, if a bunch of these pass, they're going to have differing standards, and all of a sudden they dropped their opposition to the federal level. But there's very little interest in it. Since the energy crisis in the early 70s, where people had to line up to buy gasoline, our technology's improved to the fact that you have much more efficient cars, and our average consumption in recent years per household is going way up in our cars. Everybody's got to drive an SUV. Why? We're told let's be more energy efficient. We're told the importance of it. And then for every one time you're told that, you see 50 ads saying how you're stylish, you're fashionable, you're with it to have a SUV. People who never leave a paved street or highway in a suburban community, do they need an SUV? But we all, as a society, we're moving more and more that way, so we waste energy tremendously. Alternative sources of energy, we tried a bill that made some modest steps this year in Minnesota. I think we made progress. It was, I describe it as minor steps, other than the fact that because we haven't done anything in that area for 15 years, at least it might be a sense that we're moving in that direction. But we could, I'm convinced we're doing some very foolish things in terms of our reliance on our hope to push for more hydro, which flooding lots of land, not their environmental cost to hydro, other than something like right here, a small thing that is not flooding any land, it's just using a falls and diverting it. There's energy problems, there's certainly ones with any higher fossil fuels. Coal is a tremendous problem. Nuclear ones, we don't have a clue what we're going to do with the waste of it. And the cheapest way to deal with energy is energy efficiency. Why don't we do more of it? Well, people who make the money off of energy don't make money off of conservation. I could go into more on that, but that's basically the problem. Missile defense system, I'm certainly not an expert in it, but you're right. All of our allies are saying they don't want us to do it. Will it ever work? Who knows? The one time that, like in the Clinton administration, when they did this test, remember, they sent one missile up at a time. They knew where it was going. They knew every detail about where it was headed, and they couldn't shoot it down with the system there. And the experts in the field say, well, of course, and that's just a dummy one. You have somebody sending off one, they're going to have all kinds of anti-detection things, 1,000 things that fly off of it to try and divert any defense against it. The chances of it working, I'm sure it might. And it might prevent somebody from getting hit with something, but given the response of those who are allegedly the ones who are going to fire something at us that we're defending against, seems to me, as you pointed out, the way the Soviet Union used to, they just build more to counter it, and we don't need that arms race. And if you want to figure out what the greatest risks to our country are, I was going to say terrorists doing, somebody suggested last night, what about a terrorist bombing Hanford? Hanford waste dumps and just releasing it in the atmosphere. That could make it so you wouldn't want to live in a major portion of the country. I was going to say, our biggest enemies may well be terrorist attacks in the food supply, the water supply, other things, rather than somebody firing a missile, which was the threat 20, 30, 40 years ago.
But that doesn't seem to be what's coming from the administration.
Follow the money is something people often suggest in politics. Look who contributed to the campaigns and so on. There is, there's no big industry out there in anti-terrorism stuff. That's government done stuff, and there's no lobby for it. There is a big industry for the people who produce the aerospace systems that do this. Very good jobs. That's been one of the problems with the industrial, military-industrial complexes, Dwight Eisenhower called it, in the first place. Why do we do these systems, these airplanes, the military say they don't need right now? Because it's in somebody's district and it's a lot of jobs. Missile defense system is a lot of jobs in certain communities. There's a strong lobby from certain businesses for it. But and there's strong opposition to it in Congress too. So, but clearly we're moving that direction right now to go ahead with it.
Thanks.
Yes?
In the Twin Cities, they're talking about light rail or something of that nature to save energy. Do you see that this coming, or is it just going to be a big fight and
okay,
be able to put anything together?
Well, I happen to, it's an interesting one because, yeah, we've, in transportation issues, I'm a big believer in mass transit. I actually strongly oppose the light rail line that we are putting in there because Twin Cities has very fast deterioration of our one transit system, bus system. I hadn't, when the light rail bill came through the last couple of years, I had proposed taking the same amount of money we were going to spend in that and shifting it to about five other things that I'm confident would produce at least 20 or 30 times the ridership of the system. Doing it from downtown Minneapolis to the airport to the Mall of America, the corridor anywhere near them, within 10 miles on each side of it, there's several buses that run down it now and they carry 20,000 passenger trips per day, which presumably means 10,000 people going both ways. And the new system would, if you count the buses that they leave in that system and you count the light rail system, it would carry, once it's built, between the two of them, 26,000, which is 6,000 more rides per day or 3,000 more people for what looks now like it's going to be $2/3 billion. I suggested that for a fraction of the cost, you could make every bus in the Twin Cities charge $1 for it. It charged 25 cents, or $1 now charged 25 cents for it. Instead, because of funding, we're likely to be raising it to $1.25. If you reduce the fare to, I'd say free, you do more for congestion than any other single investment in transit you could. Actually, Austin, Texas did that for a few years, and the 2 years they tripled their ridership. The only reason they shut it down wasn't that it was a success, but that homeless people were sleeping on the buses. So they had a homelessness problem that was being the solution, killing the solution to the free bus fare. You would double the ridership if you cut the fare to a quarter. And you can do that for an awful lot of years for $0.75 billion, $2/3 billion. And that would be the biggest single thing, improving service, clean fuel buses. I had a whole bunch of things that would, you could do all of them and it would cost a lot less. And I'm convinced instead of 3,000 new riders per day, you'd probably have 100,000 more riders a day. And we better be doing that. We better be doing more than that because in our Twin Cities metropolitan area, over the next 20 years, they're projecting within 20 years, and it's pretty steady growth, 2 million more passenger trips per day, vehicle trips per day over the next 20 years, which is 100,000 new passenger trips, vehicle trips per year. And that means under the current LRT system, you'd have to build 16 of those lines that size every year just to keep up with congestion. So I'm a big believer in public transit. The difficulty is it works in New York, it works in Boston, Chicago, cities that were built around a transit system, but Twin Cities, well, we do well in some things. It's one of the fastest sprawling areas in the country, 60 acres a day we grow by. And it's a little bit here, a little bit there, 60 acres a day we're sprawling, and the housing density is so sparse that in that line, I'm not sure that was the smartest one, but I'm a big believer in transit. I think it's far cheaper than building roads. And I frankly love trains. We took trains out here a couple of years ago, and I think we should be building high-speed rail between cities. It's far more energy efficient than airline travel, far more environmentally sound than that. And if we invested in it, it would be a big investment, but I think we could do so much to reduce fuel consumption and so on by that. And rail transit is in that sense more efficient, but only if the numbers justify it. So it is, we're building the one, but it's a lot of money and it'll be fun,
more money too.
I think the Mall of America had big reason for lobbying for it in the Minneapolis Downtown Council. It's great for their tourism travel, but the buses, frankly, are fast as that. You could build, I have a personal rapid transit system that University of Minnesota guy put together, which is energy efficient beyond both of those and makes sense, but that's not
my thing. It's going to cost more with that downtown bottleneck they've got too, because the right where they want the rail, it's going to be more.
Yeah,
all that stuff they're going to dig up is going to be more.
It's extremely expensive to do, and again, I worked in Washington, D.C. 1 year in 1977. I was in college and I was an intern for half a year and stayed around longer. And that was the year that Washington first opened its metro subway system. They had a decent bus system, not the world's best, but they had one. They put the metro in, and it's a very dense system. And I remember for Jimmy Carter's inauguration in January 77, it was the people's inauguration, which everybody's done since then. They hype it more and more, but they were expecting large crowds of people. So what did they do? In order to avoid traffic congestion, they gave free rides on the metro system, the buses and the thing. And the congressman I was working for, we talked about, you know, since Washington, D.C. has all these air quality problems and it's all vehicle, it's not industrial there, why don't you, whenever the air quality reaches this danger level, provide free rides on the transit system? The transit system people weren't really interested. The people there who seemed to be talking to them said, well, we couldn't handle all the riders. I was going to say, maybe we should learn from that. But bring down the fares, and the subsidy per ride actually may go down because you have so many more riders.
What's the most effective way that you think your constituency can communicate with you? And do you think that there are enough people who do take enough interest?
The whole issue, how you contact, by the way, I will be doing a session on this topic in more detail on Monday. But briefly, no, there aren't enough people who take interest, and it's partly because life is busy. I mean, everybody has their own family, their own work, their own interests, everything else, and there's a sense of futility that if I write a letter, does it change anything? Well, yeah, one letter, can you prove it makes a difference? Well, I've seen letters that have suggested an idea or something else that have made something really happen. In terms of, I urge your opposition to, let's take the missile defense system. A lot of members of Congress and President and others have their minds made up on it. So one letter is not going to change a mind, usually. And at the federal level or bigger, higher offices, where they're getting now email, they're getting, I read a couple of weeks ago how much they were getting in the U.S. Senate now, how many million pieces a month, and divide it by 100 people, it's still hundreds of thousands. They can't possibly go through them all, and people are blast faxing everybody, and how much is being read. Email is a very convenient way to do it. It's smaller offices, county commissioner, except in like a state like California, other states, legislative offices, they're small enough that they tend to see this sort of thing. is one way to do it. Phone call, letter, any of them makes a difference. Visiting in person is, if you live near a capital city or visiting legislators in their home districts, those things all, the more powerful impact comes from the more effort put into it sometimes. You write a postcard, dear Senator, fill in the blank, sign so-and-so. The sheer quantity of them will make people take notice. And do they weigh the mail to a certain extent? There is a, wow, there's a lot of opposition to this, we're gonna anger people. If it's kind of, oh, somebody took the time, somebody had a stack of postcards, sign this, we'll deliver them all. You get the sense there's not as much strong will. They're not gonna vote you out of office because you didn't vote for what they wanted. Some of my colleagues, though, in a state legislature like Minnesota, I mean, you get 10 letters on something, you take notice. Some of the church groups have done some things on affordable housing, and I think it's, we haven't done a lot in that area, but I think there's been more done in recent years because of the letters about that issue. So there are a variety of ways to do it. The more, and if you're writing letters and you ask questions in it, you know, then you can't just send the form letter response. You can go, well, how do you feel about this? Or why are you taking this position on this? Or could you tell me if this would work? You ask a specific question or two, they either have to respond specifically to you or they send you a form letter. Thanks for your views, I appreciate hearing them. And then you send a letter back saying, you didn't answer my questions. What about this and this? At a certain point, they get the sense, hey, I better do this. So asking questions is a headache, is a recipient, but it does get more attention. And I'll talk more about that issue on Monday, too, and how to organize more than one-on-one as well in terms of making a difference. Other topics? Go ahead.
And you want to comment on the recent change in the party with Jeffers and...
Okay.
I've heard rumors McCain is contemplating the idea possibly and how that would affect Washington.
Okay. For Jeffords and if McCain does it personally, I think it was a big win situation for him. If you switch parties from the majority party to the minority party, you lose a lot. Switching from the majority to the minority, you gain a lot sometimes. Switching parties and making the majority switch with you, you gain a whole lot. I don't think politically it's going to hurt Jeffords in Vermont. I think that fits his image and everything else well. It's not going to hurt him. And in terms of that sense, if you were John McCain and thinking of switching parties to independent or something else, and if you were able, well, he's now no longer has a committee chairmanship because he's in the minority now. For Jefford's situation, if you wanted to look at it from a cynical point of view, if Strom Thurmond dies any week, which is certainly possible, I mean, he's not really there. They've had to drag him in, wheel him in on a wheelchair and so on a few times for things, but his health is very poor. He's 98 years old now. And the projection is that sometime in the next year or so, he may well have to resign. In which case, the party switch would have occurred at that point anyhow. I think Jeffords looked at it and he was troubled by what happened. And I heard a lot of people saying, well, why didn't he switch and not allow the tax bill to happen? I don't know how he feels about the tax bill, but the tax bill in many ways binds the federal government in terms of what money they have for the next 10 years or so. It doesn't have to, they could undo anything they want at any time, but even he delayed his party switch, he said, or he announced it a week before the tax bill went through and he had voted for the tax bill, so he must have wanted it to happen. But it's a pretty major power control of the legislature. I feel like I'm in the minority. For the 14 years I've been there, I've been in the majority party, but that's just because of disagreements with colleagues on that. But again, I have a committee chair, more staff than I'd have if I was in the minority. And so definitely the direction and control, even if there's a lot of disagreements within a party, as there always are in modern politics, there's still, there's a big importance in it. And again, you notice it in terms of who's chairing key committees like foreign relations and judiciary. Some of those committees, it's in terms of confirmation of federal judges, those are some big changes. Other things? Yeah, go ahead.
In line with what was said before with this party change, how does the people, followers, I mean the ones who voted in one party or another party, what does that do to the people back home?
Repeat the question.
The question was how a party switch like that affects the people back home, how they feel about it. Well, I mean, they don't really have much they can do about it until the next election, U.S. Senate 6 years down the road. One of my colleagues who was a Democrat and not much in philosophy, I was going to say he voted most often with the other party, he endorsed Republican candidates for president for years and so on, and he decided after this recent election he was going to switch parties. To everybody's surprise, he switched and became Independence Party, the governor's, our governor's party. And what does he have in common with our governor? Beats me. He doesn't agree with him on much any issue. I mean, I was going to say he doesn't agree with him on social policy issues, on economic issues, on much of anything. Though it has. Our governor has supported a campaign finance reform proposal I've been pushing, and so this guy, who has always opposed those things because it's a big issue with the governor, he signed on as a co-author of the bill, and I was going to say, so it's interesting he decided to do some things the governor liked because he's in the governor's party. What do his constituents feel? Well, I think most people really, while they may say, I consider myself a Democrat or a Republican or independent, most of them really do vote for the person more than that. Why did Minnesota have Paul Wellstone, who was seen on one end of the political spectrum, and I don't like using the political spectrum, but for convenience I will here, and Rod Grams, who was at the other end of the political spectrum, seldom agreed on anything. How did they both get a majority? Different people voted? No, it was roughly the same people voted. It was different years. And then Jesse Ventura, who's neither was all over the place in various ways and didn't know where he stood. I mean, he didn't tax policy reported as where you stand on when you're going to put out your budget, your ideas like this. I don't know if I will. Did it matter to people? No, he was different and they liked it. And people vote for a lot of things other than political party, a lot of things other than even ideology. And they have to decide. They may get angry at somebody for betraying them. And usually when you see a party switch, you see somebody like Jeffords go to great length to talk to some key supporters. And he said, I know some people will be very disappointed in me. I think it's consistent with what I've stood for. And there have been party switches both ways. Minnesota had our state auditor switch parties, and one of our state senators, who was the former minority leader, switched parties a year later after he had been dumped as being minority leader. Neither were they surprises. Well, because they happened a week apart, they were both surprises. I didn't know either was happening. But people usually, they get reelected afterwards. In most cases they do. I'm sure there are cases where it hasn't happened. One of my colleagues has switched. He was a Republican for a while, then an independent, then a Democrat, then an independent. Now he's a Republican again. In 16 years, he's been in just independent or Democrat or Republican. Two times each, and his constituents keep reelecting him, whatever he is. So,
is there anything ever said about mandatory retirement for politicians?
Mandatory retirement for politicians, constitutionally, I don't think you could do that. You'd have to amend the U.S. Constitution to allow that. Term limits, which has been upheld in the courts, has been talked about instead. My own personal feeling, and I know the states that have done it have had mixed feelings about it. I haven't favored, I think that's what elections are for. I think our system suffers because too many politicians are out there trying to say what they think is popular. The the theory is that the Democrat has to reach to the left end of the spectrum to get their nomination, and the Republican has to reach to the right end of the spectrum, and then they move to the center for the general election. That's what political theorists and commentators and consultants tell you to do. I wish people would stand for something. I think it's much more healthy if people, if you're over here, and I don't see the spectrum as this way, I see it over here in the, all over the thing. And what's a centrist? Somebody who averages out to be the center. They're on the left on one issue and the right on another issue. Again, our governor says he's a centrist, and this guy who switched to his party, both would call themselves centrists. But which issues they're on this side and which issues they're on that side are opposite of each other. So they don't agree on nothing, but they're both centrists. I happen to think that we're better off as a system if we have people who speak their mind, who fight for what they believe in, and we have a good, thoughtful debate with differing ideas put out there, not the candidates trying to see how similar they can sound, but they want to grab a little more of what they think is the middle than the other one. And if so, and how does this relate to the question of age limits or term limits or things like that, I think we'd have a healthier debate that way, because elections are where you're supposed to limit terms. If I support some position that's unpopular, and I know one I do, I'm sure I do plenty of them, I know I do, plenty that are unpopular with constituents, death penalty is one that a majority, I've seen polls say that majority favors it, I don't favor it. I don't duck from that and hope nobody notices. I spell out why I feel that way and try and argue for it and try and persuade people, and usually, well, I don't agree with you on that issue, but I trust your judgment, I whatever. And if not, they should vote me out. If they don't trust my judgment, if they disagree with me too much, they ought to vote me out of office. And so I don't favor term limits that way. I think the state of California, where they 20-year veterans and so on, now everybody's out after 6 years, I think. I think they have mixed feelings whether that's good or not. There's a lot of switching, people running for Congress because their term limit is up there, they're running for county commissioner, mayor of San Francisco because their time in the legislature is up. And there's a whole lot of hypocrisy because politicians figure it's a popular issue. Eastern Washington, I remember 1994, a Speaker of the House, U.S. House, was defeated by somebody who promised, it was his key issue, we got to have turnover, we got to have new people in place. He won re-election. He won the election, upset the Speaker of the House, first time at least this century that's happened. 6 years, and I think he said something like, if I run again after 6 years, vote against me. Don't let him pay my salary, don't anything. I think he said that kind of language, the things I read, and then 6 years came up, and what do you know? He found things a little different. You get more power, you learn this. He's re-evaluated his position. And again, from an outsider reading, I heard an article about some guy dressed as a weasel following him around. He still won re-election. I'd say we ought to make our elections more competitive, but the thing that bothers me is not that he ran for re-election, but that after making it a major issue and a reason to defeat somebody, you go back on your pledge. I mean, that bothers me more than whether somebody, some people legitimately favor it. I happen to think that we should have some new people, we should have some very senior people, because there's some benefit to continuity, but age limits would be unconstitutional or that sort of thing, but you could do it with term limits, which is. Over here.
You have to have some optimism about the political process, or you wouldn't be a politician yourself. But there is so much sense of futility in the country about the political process. How could you encourage us in that regard?
Okay, I'd like to change it to say I'm not an optimist. I'm a hopeful person. I think there's a big difference between hope and optimism, and I think people here understand the concept, the Christian concept of hope. There's not always a grounds to be really optimistic. I think we're doing some horrendous things in terms of long-term environmental neglect. A lot of things we could and should be doing, and we're very much our generations, these two or three generations that are alive at this time. I think the first time in human history we've been able to destroy the world, destroy ourselves, and and we seem to be well set to doing so, not in our lifetime. I think the nuclear holocaust that we were worried about is not likely to happen. It's still possible, but I think the bigger risks are that we're going to destroy the world for two generations from now. That's something we should be really frightened about, horrified about. And can we change it? Well, I was going to suggest the reason you need the hope is if you go by pessimism or optimism, you may too often decide it isn't worth it. It's futile. Dan Erlander this morning was talking about how, you know, his response to somebody who does something really mean or whatever, responding in kindness, is it going to change the whole world? No, but some others might copy it. It changes some people. It has some impact. I can tell you lots of things I've succeeded in changing the political debate. A lot of things. Have I lost more than I've won? Yeah. You just keep plugging away at it. I think we're not necessarily called to win every battle. We're called to do the best we can. And what I like to do is whenever I see people I look up to in politics are not necessarily public officials, but people, I can think of one activist who spent his entire adult life trying to change things, environmental things, economic policies. The guy works long hours. He's fought in a whole lot of losing causes, but the guy he's very persistent. He's took a sabbatical from his political activism and got a fellowship and studied for a year, came back to it again. I was going to say, people like that I look up to because you need somebody who's persistent and who has hope, and I learned from that, and I figure if I quit fighting, there's more work for others who would agree with me and who want to see the same changes. It's more work for them if I quit, so you keep plugging away.
Well, I was just going to say that you are brave enough to say what you believe in, but it seems like it's hard for us when they're campaigning sometimes to find out, even if they listen to a debate, find out what they really
that's a major problem.
Because there's,
yeah.
You
don't need to put any issue down. Our American system has gotten to the point where you don't have to put out any issue papers, anything. You just run a lot of ads. And very simple things that don't tell much. And there's nothing wrong. My campaigns have pictures of the family. And first time I ran, people offered to loan us a dog for the family photo. We now have the dog, and we have the dog in the campaign photos. Is there anything wrong with it? No, it makes people think you're like them, and you're an ordinary person, and I like to think I am, and I'd like them to know that. But there's also some sort of obligation as public officials and candidates to talk about issues and be upfront about them. There's some obligation of the media to force that to happen. There's some obligation of the public to demand it to happen. First time I read 20-some pages of very detailed issue papers that somebody said my opponent was the only one who read them, so he could know what to attack. But I made them all available many times. Everything said that you could call for a copy of them. And then I'd carry around when I was going door to door, which is the common way you campaign in a legislative race of the size of mine. And Connie and I did more door-to-door than anybody else ever did, which may have been why it was an upset victory. But in the brochures I'd have with all the nice pictures and saying what I wanted to do, I'd have a one-page summary of the issue papers. And you go in late summer and you see some guy sitting out on his porch step and you hand him the stuff and look back a few houses later, the guy's sitting there reading the thing. You give him information, not everybody's going to read it. You figure a third of it's going in the recycling before they look at anything outside of the top cover. But you hand somebody something, could you take a look at this? I'd appreciate it. Appreciate your consideration. You know, some people actually do read it. And what do you do as a member of the public if nobody gives you that? Well, with the internet and everything else, it's getting easier to demand. I want some information. Trouble is candidates have learned the ways around it. One candidate for mayor in a local community promised on his website, he's the one candidate not afraid to talk about the issues. And he said, see his website for more details. A reasonable guy, nice guy, he's okay mayor. but he sent out a thing, see my website for details. You look at his website, last time I looked at it was about 2 weeks before the election. Issue section, coming soon. wasn't there. And how many people took the time to look at it? No, but wow, this is the one candidate talking about the issues. So I don't know that there's an easy answer other than it's an obligation of the candidates, and it's an obligation of the media, and it's an obligation of the public, and all of us are doing a poor job at it. And if people, part of the trouble is that the public, they get fluff, so what do you expect? Fluff. You don't expect the issue stuff and the debates. I think even when there's small numbers paying attention, it's worth doing for that small percentage. And it's no easy answer. I wish I had one.
I don't know. Time for one or two more. Has the energy question already been asked?
We talked about that a little bit, and I'd be happy to talk more about it afterwards. But if there's another question, we can do that because we have about two.
Just two quick questions, I guess. One, how did you yourself get involved in politics? How did you get involved in politics?
Okay.
And then the other question related to that is, how does someone get involved either locally or nationally when it seems that it costs so much? The American dream was anybody can become president. Mm-hmm. That's, I don't always say that's realistic in terms of our current system.
Well, anybody who's got a lot of money or anyone who has a lot of friends with a lot of money can get elected. Yeah, I was going to say, is a Democrat looking at George Bush, did he win the nomination because he had more thoughtful ideas than Elizabeth Dole or others? I don't think anybody would argue that case. There were 10, 15 Republicans in the race at one point. Bush won because he had the best connections with the money. How do you get involved? Well, it's a long story how I got involved. It was a passion for changing things, belief that this was a good way to do it. Happy to talk more. The only thing I will tell people about getting involved is I discourage people who want a title in front of their name. I used to have all these, when I was first elected age 30, and all these young college graduates, political science major, wanted to go to law school, wanted to become public official. What did they care about? Oh, I don't know, education, taxes, you name it. They had no passion for it, no reason for being there. I'd rather encourage somebody who has a belief in something to. But I'd be happy to talk more with you about it if you want. I'd strongly encourage people who care to get involved because you can't make a difference if you don't. And with that, time is up. I hear the bells ringing already. So thank you very much for your attention.